Welcome to Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Today we're going to continue our investigation of Planktos Corp. This company plans to farm ocean algae, stimulating them with iron dust to capture carbon dioxide from the air. If successful, the company would sell carbon offset credits to polluting companies and individuals like you. Last week, we ran a full-length interview with the chief visionary and CEO, Russell George. If you haven't heard it, go ahead and download last week's show from our website at ecoshock.org. Russ is an inspiring speaker about reforestation on land and restoring phytoplankton at sea. It all hinges on the company's ship, the Weatherbird 2, currently docked in Florida. Will it sail to dump 100 tons of iron dust in the far Pacific? Will a combination of environmental groups and government agencies act to stop it? Or will it simply run out of money before it can go? In a press release and in our last interview, Russell George claimed that he had some support from Greenpeace. We now go to Dr. David Santillo at the Greenpeace Lab in Exeter, UK, to discuss the science behind this Planktos seeding business.
To get more on the science behind claims made by Planktos Corporation, we are joined by David Santillo of the Greenpeace Science Unit in Exeter, UK. Welcome, David.
Thank you very much.
Well, David, Greenpeace has been looking into this idea of seeding of plankton and the claims of carbon capture. What have you found?
The claims that are being made, we feel, are very overblown, inappropriate, given the level of uncertainty which still exists in the science. There are certain things here which are undoubtedly the case. Firstly, iron is an essential nutrient for phytoplankton growth. And secondly, there are indeed areas of the equatorial Pacific, of the subarctic, the Southern Ocean, where it does seem that productivity is in some way limited by nutrients other than nitrogen and phosphorus, and iron has been implicated in those cases. And certainly in those areas, if you add iron, that you can often stimulate a growth of phytoplankton. All of those things are clear. Those have been repeated with various experiments over the years. Last 10 or 15 years. To go from those scientific observations, however, to a hypothesis that ocean ecosystems can be restored and climate change even reversed by addition of iron, large-scale addition of iron to the oceans, involves a huge leap of faith. It makes some very big assumptions. It ignores the uncertainties surrounding the science regarding iron utilization, and in fact it ignores some of the wealth of scientific evidence which has emerged over those experiments in the past 10 to 15 years, which indicates that iron fertilization is in fact not a sensible and probably not even a likely effective approach for mitigating climate change.
Well, let's talk about that. One is sensible and the other is effective. What are some of the problems that might come up?
There are a number of things. I think what you need to look at is firstly the potential for adverse impacts, those unexpected collateral impacts that you can have from making any kind of human-induced change to ecosystems. And then secondly, to look at whether, in fact, even if you do get a bloom of plankton, that leads to effective drawdown and storage, long-term storage of additional carbon in the marine environment. So to look at the ecological impacts, adding nutrients of any sort generally involves not only an increase in the productivity, an increase in biomass, it very often means a change in the balance of different species in the plankton. You can get a shift from smaller species to larger ones, sometimes the other way around in a fairly unpredictable way. But what you do is change the basis of the whole ecosystem. The marine ecosystem relies on the planktonic algae as the basis for all of the productivity and marine life out in these open ocean ecosystems. And we should be very wary about making fundamental changes to that by adding iron or indeed any other nutrient on such a large scale. And then to look at the efficacy of sequestration, the experiments that have been conducted to date show that, in fact, a lot of the blooms that are produced by adding iron are very short-lived. The transfer of carbon from the surface layers down into deeper waters that would be necessary in order to lock away the CO2 in any effective way is really quite inefficient in most cases. And even if you do get, in one particular case, a fairly good transfer of carbon into deeper waters, it's no guarantee that it's going to stay there. It's not something that can be verified in terms of a positive impact on carbon balance and climate change. And the type of the sort of scale that would be necessary in terms of iron fertilization in order to generate real changes to the climatic system are just colossal. I mean, they're well and beyond any of the experiments that have been conducted to date.
So we might need 1,000 ships or something like that to really have an effect?
Well, I think even if you could get to the point where you were fairly confident of some reliable transfer of carbon from the surface into deeper water, yes, you would be looking at thousands of ships operating continuously in order to produce the types of changes that are being proposed. But I think before you get to that point, you have to remember that the uncertainties in the way in which that iron would be used are still very great. And even those researchers which are looking, the research groups that are looking at iron use in the ocean, that are looking at the results from the fertilization experiments to date, one thing they come back to again and again are the huge uncertainties, the gaps in knowledge that we have about the way in which iron is utilized by marine plankton and the way in which any addition of iron is ultimately going to impact on the ecosystems as a whole.
Well, do you think that this particular company, from what you've seen, is in a position to add to our scientific knowledge about it? I mean, should we let it go as just a research voyage?
I don't think we should let it go as a research voyage, because clearly that's not what it's being designed and promoted as. There are a number of experiments that are going on at the moment, the number that have been going on since the early 90s in various parts of the world's oceans, in the equatorial Pacific initially in the early 90s, Southern Ocean in the late 90s, coming through to the South Atlantic and the Northeast Subarctic in more recent years. These have all been designed as the scientific experiments in order to determine more about the way in which iron is utilized by marine plankton and the way in which carbon is sequestered, how that's recycled, how much of it actually drops out of the water column into deeper waters. The difference with the proposal that's coming from Planktos and indeed from other companies is that there is a degree of commercialization here. The proposal is quite clearly to go out and test this as a proof of concept for an eco-restoration experiment. The researchers, Russ George, the CEO of Planktos, and the others that are involved, they seem convinced that this is going to work. I think they're the only ones that are convinced. And I think for them to go out on the back of this research and to begin promoting carbon credits, carbon offsets, that people could purchase on the back of these experiments, I think is very disingenuous.
So in a nutshell, what would the Greenpeace position on this seeding venture be?
We feel that, that the Planktos venture, and in fact any other proposal to commercialize this whole issue of iron fertilization, should not be going ahead. It shouldn't be permitted at this stage. And companies like Planktos should take a far more ethical stance on this and not look at their continuing the iron seeding experiments by whatever means. Planktos has fallen foul in to some degree of the potential for US law to regulate their activities. And their response, rather than to explore that in more detail, to look again at whether in fact what they were proposing was acceptable, was simply to say, well, in that case, we'll go beyond the U.S. We won't use U.S. flagged vessels. We're going to do this come what may. And I think that that sets them apart from the other research groups which are pursuing research into nutrient dynamics, into the fate of iron which is placed in the oceans, and the way in which that impacts with the plankton, in fact the way in which plankton interact with the climate. It's being done in general with a much more scientific basis, looking at our understanding of the way in which these ecosystems work and respond. With companies like Planktos, it's specifically designed as a proof of concept in order to commercialize iron fertilization at a time when the uncertainties remain very big and the evidence suggests that, in fact, it won't be an effective mechanism of sequestering carbon. And for that reason, we feel that this shouldn't be allowed to go ahead as a proof of concept for a commercial operation.
From England, we've been speaking with Dr. David Santillo of the Greenpeace Science Unit, and thanks for taking the time to explain this to our listeners.
We've looked at the science, but now, my friends, it is time to get down to business. Don't run away from these tedious facts, because they reveal a fascinating cast of characters, I promise. According to corporate filings, the current Planktos Corp. began life on December 10, 1996, as eWorld Travel Corp. In 2002, it was renamed GYK Ventures, in July 2005 to Diatom Corporation. In 2007, Diatom was renamed Planktos Corp. While company names and large blocks of stock were thrashing this year, Russell George popped up in a string of media photo ops and promotions while courting environmental groups. Despite all the good publicity in newspapers and network TV, Planktos shareholders watched their value plummet. From a high of $2.56 a share at some point, by September 7th, the stock was worth about 84 cents a share at most. On their website, Businessweek says, "The goals of Planktos insiders are closely aligned with those of the shareholders, because insiders own a greater percentage of this company than at any other company in the commercial services and supplies industry." Well, that's quite a record. Insiders own more of this company than any other in these listings out of countless companies. And then we have the Panama connection. Planktos Corp. was formed from Diatom Company, but who owned that? According to an SEC filing, February 12, 2007, the largest single owner of Diatom stock was Gabriela Samaniego of Panama City, Panama. In February, Gabriela owned 23 million shares of Diatom, or 42% of common stock. Lots of new Planktos stock was created, splitting from about 54 million shares to nearly 81 million. Another large block of stock, almost 7% of the company, was held by another Panamanian company named Investment Track Group. In 2004, that was listed as a shelf company, but somebody bought it off the shelf. Now, do these Central American shadows represent Mr. Scalbania or a Panamanian millionaire? Who is trading offshore, hidden? Let's get some real expertise.
Planktos Corporation is just the latest incarnation arising from a confusing number of shell companies associated with CEO Russell George and his major financial backer in Vancouver, Canada. It's way beyond my expertise, but nothing escapes the wary eye of Vancouver Sun financial columnist David Baines. David, we're honored to have you on the program.
Well, thank you very much. That's a flattering comment you make about nothing escaping me. In fact, a lot escapes me. Unfortunately, there are 8 million stories in the Naked City.
Well, Russell George assures me his company is legit because it is traded on the stock market, but this isn't a regular market. What is the OTC bulletin board market?
Well, it's not a stock exchange in the sense that we know it. For example, the Toronto Stock Exchange, if you have a company that you want to get listed on it, you have to apply. You have to meet certain financial criteria. There are certain maintenance, listing and maintenance requirements. You have to have invested so much. You have to have a certain shareholder distribution, and you have to follow the rules of the stock exchange. And your trading is subject to scrutiny by Market Regulation Services, which is the regulatory body which oversees trading on Canadian exchanges. So all of this is absent in the bulletin board. The bulletin board is just basically a place where it's an over-the-counter market where you can post bids or asks for stock and trade it through a quotation system, an electronic quotation system. So it's an electronic system rather than a proper stock exchange.
So it's a bit of a Wild West with a lot less regulation. Is that the idea?
Oh, yes. Well, you have to make certain requisite filings with the SEC. You have to file financial statements. Up until a few years ago, you didn't even have to do that. But financial statements and press releases and so on have to be filed. But I'll tell you, there's there's so much nonsense that goes on in this exchange, and just because you filed a piece of nonsense with the SEC doesn't make it any less nonsensical. It's a magnet for fraudsters, for frauds and fraudsters, and in particular Vancouver promoters love this as a forum for their trading, and particularly since the regulators clamped down on illicit dealing in Vancouver. There's been a bit of a cleanup. The TSX Venture Exchange now is much cleaner than the old Vancouver Exchange, or a lot less ridiculous, let's say. And so promoters have found new, more hospitable markets down south in the form of the OTC bulletin board.
Well, I asked Mr. George who controls Planktos. His answer was a little evasive at first, but it led back to a Nevada-based company with offices here in British Columbia called Solar Energy Limited. What can you tell us about that company?
Well, Solar is the vehicle which is the manager of Solar is Nelson Scalbania, and he is also one of the largest shareholders. It's basically a shell company. Doesn't really have an active business. It is the vehicle through which Planktos has become public and will and is publicly trading.
Is it a problem that Nelson Scalbania is involved?
Well, it depends who you're talking to. I mean, I've been following Nelson for many years, and it's very fair to say that he's had a very checkered career. You may recall during the big real estate boom in the early 80s, he was one of the real estate one of the big real estate flippers in Vancouver and elsewhere. He was very highly levered. When the market collapsed, so did he, and he left a lot of creditors high and dry. He then became involved in a whole series of Vancouver Stock Exchange companies. These are classic penny stocks that promised much and delivered little or nothing. And then there was more serious problems that he got into with the police. And at one juncture, he was charged with stealing $100,000 out of, I believe he was associated with a real estate company or ran a real estate company, and he had taken money out of trust for his personal purposes. He had, in fact, returned that money, but nevertheless, the violation had occurred, and he was prosecuted and convicted of that. And as I recall, he served 1 year with one of these electronic ankle monitoring bracelets.
But, you know, I met Nelson Scalbania by accident back in the early 90s, and even then I questioned him about the environment. He was interested in it. He has been trying to develop these companies. Do you suppose it's possible that he really has a green streak in him as well?
Well, I found it really quite interesting because when I went to meet him, I mean, he was very open and receptive, and he seemed genuinely enthusiastic about this Planktos and the whole business that they were entering into. He seemed sold on the science. Indeed, I was struck with his earnestness. But, you know, on the other hand, that's a sign of a good promoter that can, promote a whole variety of different projects with different economic potential with equal zeal.
Well, it looks like another of George's companies and related to Mr. Scalbania, D2 Fusion, may be headed for obscurity. This year it failed to deliver a rumored product, a multi-kilowatt home heater using fusion energy. And last February, a company named Shadow Marketing claimed to have purchased D2 Fusion, but now it's been apparently sold to another shell company called Enwin Resources, which is also based in Vancouver. And yet, you know, just a few days ago I talked with Russell George, and he promised major new announcements for D2 Fusion coming up real soon. What do you make of this company?
Well, really, I don't make too much of it. I've been focusing on planktos. I'm aware of the D2 fusion, that there are developments in that area, but planktos has been the enterprise which has been garnering all the attention and has not only Mr. George, but Mr. Scalbania at its center.
And there's been a lot of news stories about it, but in two columns in the Vancouver Sun, you've advised investors to be careful about getting involved with planktos.
Oh, well, I think that's always good advice, no matter what stock you're getting involved in. But there are clear red flags when you're talking specifically about planktos, and one is the method of promotion. The planktos is being promoted by one of these dreadful newsletter writers in the States who they use hysterically hyperbolic language to try to hype the stock and to induce investors to buy it. In this case, it's a fellow, this U.S. newsletter writer. His name is Remo Sabine Jr., and he's editor-in-chief of this tout sheet called Ground Floor Stocks. And he talks about, it uses language now, there's no time to wait, get fat now, or fight for the scraps. Global Warming Inc., that's what Wall Street insiders will call planktos, as sales of its carbon credits sent it soaring from $1.25 to $30. So there you go. You better move quickly if you want to cash in on this bonanza. So, and if you look at the disclaimer, it's finance. It's part of a $250,000 U.S. Public relations campaign that's financed by a company called Profit Ridge Investments. Now, we don't know who Profit Ridge is, and I asked Nelson Scalbania, and he said his exact quote response was, "I don't know and I don't care." Well, I do care, because we're supposed to believe that this is some interested third party who wants to get the word out, but too often these third party financiers are insiders. The insiders themselves are people who are very related closely to the insiders, and so it's not an arms-length kind of promotion. It provides an opportunity for insiders to dump their stock. Now, I'm not saying that's happened here. I'm saying that's been the pattern in the past.
Well, as a neophyte looking through the planktos security filings, I was perplexed. It seems like there are two companies, both named planktos. One is Planktos Inc. and the other Planktos Corp. One buys the other, but all the same people are involved. And somewhere along the line, another company, Diatom, appears and disappears. Why all the shifting company names and apparently internal trades among the same people?
There could be a variety of reasons. Usually, it's this kind of jockeying goes on to make sure that the asset gets into the vehicle which has the most advantageous share structure for the insiders. Again, I'm not saying that's what's happening here, but that is usually quite often the case.
We're speaking with Vancouver Sun columnist David Baines. David, it seems like every day I see a story about a new multi-million-dollar fund looking to buy carbon credits. My reading is the principals could make a lot of money if they could hold on long enough, and their financial filings look a little rocky. A lot of publicity, but so far, no revenues. Do you think they can hang on?
No, I don't. So far, the company has announced and I thought this was a little, I wasn't very impressed with this. The planktos announced that a Vancouver hotel, the Wedgwood Hotel, had agreed to buy sufficient carbon credits to offset its emissions for the next 10 years. And the first thing is there was no disclosure of the fact that the Wedgwood Hotel belongs to Eleni Skalbania, who is Nelson Skalbania's wife. Secondly, there was no disclosure as to what this meant in dollars and cents. Skalbania subsequently told me that the Wedgwood had agreed to buy sufficient carbon credits to offset their estimated 500 tons of carbon dioxide the hotel emits each year for the next 10 years. So 500 tons, Nelson told me that cost they had agreed to pay $5 per ton. So that's only $2,500 per year. Now that's chump change. That won't take you anywhere. Then the company announced some weeks later in very grand style that the Vatican had agreed to take some of these carbon credits, and but that was just a donation, and it was on account of the forests which the company plans to plant in Hungary, as opposed to the whole business of seeding the plankton blooms off the Galapagos. So the Vatican was staying away from the very controversial aspect of this company. So the company's got to come up with some money if it's not generating revenues, or more critically, cash flow. It's got to come up with some money elsewhere, and that means either going to the equity markets or trying to get some private debt, or getting some equity, and that's a tough row to hoe. This thing hasn't proved as promotable as I thought it was going to be. The stock has gone up as high as $1.60. It's trading at $1 now. That's for a total market capitalization of about $80 million. And I don't think the volume's been very exceptional, so the opportunities for the promoters to make money hasn't been as great as I thought.
Is there anything else you'd like to tell our listeners about Planktos?
Well, I just think that there is a more general message to be conveyed here. Concerns about global warming heighten, and interest in all things green becomes more intense, chances are that we'll get more and more investment offerings in the green area, whether it's carbon credits or devices, internal combustion engines with, new and improved emission control devices within them, that kind of thing. We're likely to get more and more dubious offerings in this area. And so the investor, I think, has to be even more discerning and discriminating when they're making their investment choices.
Well, there you go. Expert opinion from a man who's seen it all, David Baines, the investigative columnist for the Vancouver Sun. David, we really appreciate your help on this intriguing case.
Thank you for inviting me.
You are listening to Radio EcoShop. I'm Alex Smith, and we're checking out the carbon offset market and the new venture called Planktos Corp. A newspaper profile of Nelson Skalbania, the largest stockholder of Planktos, lists his many failed business ventures and the famous sports teams he's owned. In the Globe and Mail newspaper on November 17, 2003, we find this quote. He is the kind of guy that you go to when you have some crazy idea and a sliver or a hair chance of getting it financed, said Wolfgang Richter, a Victoria developer. When it comes to environmental solutions, Skalbania has been the go-to guy for a number of fringe ideas. It's not just nuclear fusion for the home market or plankton planting. There was hydro-air technologies championed by Dr. Melvin Pruitt. They hope to develop commercially viable electric power using the energy from water evaporation. No prototype was developed, and research was abandoned. Solar has a 30% interest in Renewable Energy Limited. This time the scientist was Dr. Reed Jensen. He proposed using solar light to grab carbon dioxide out of the air, turning it into electricity. Imagine endless electricity out of the air with just the sun as a power source. Sadly, the project was also abandoned by Solar Energy Limited. They are no longer involved. Do we see a pattern here? In each case, a champion of a fantastic new invention that will save the environment makes all kinds of press releases, looks like a company, builds stock momentum, and then fades away with no commercial product, just like D2 Fusion so far. The optimist would say Mr. Scalbania has a soft heart for dreamers. He is willing to find financing, to try almost anything, to solve the world's problems while making money. The cynic would see a repeating pattern of green promises, company promotion, stock sales, and then no product or revenues. Some call that technique a pump and dump. We can't spend a lot of time on D2 Fusion, the sister company to Planktos, other than as a guide to our confidence in Russell George and his crew. In the late 1980s, Russell George stumbled upon one of his life passions, the idea of making endless energy from the fusion of atoms. You may have heard of fusion energy as a multi-million dollar project of big governments requiring very special materials to withstand heat as hot as the sun itself. But in 1989, two scientists claimed they created fusion energy in a simple lab at room temperature. That was called cold fusion. The two scientists, Fleischmann and Pons, were discredited somewhat when the results could not be duplicated. The debate continues, and there are claims the experiment has been done. A series of attempts to develop cold fusion continued. George was invited to watch experiments by scientists, becoming enchanted by the possibilities, and apparently taught himself about the field. SEC filings for D2 Fusion state that Russell George is, quote, a recognized expert in advanced nuclear physics, end quote. In fact, he has no formal training in physics at all. Although some early D2 Fusion web pages called him Dr. George, his 4-year degree is in biology. Yet, Russ George is quite intelligent. He has presented papers at seminars. Important inventions can happen outside universities. George and his company continue to state, quote, Mr. George's successful experimental prototypes have been tested at the Los Alamos National Laboratory and Stanford Research Institute. However, Russ George has a persistent critic online, the editor of a newsletter on fusion energy called New Energy Times. It's Steve Krivit, spelled K-R-I-V-I-T. Distrusting claims made by D2 Fusion, Krivit has checked on the company. He says the truth has been stretched, sometimes to the breaking point. In particular, he found that neither the Los Alamos National Laboratory nor Stanford Research Institute acknowledged successful fusion testing by Russell George. In issue 16 of the New Energy Times, Krivit writes, according to SRI International, that claim doesn't hold water. The information in this SEC 10-K filing is not accurate, L.A. Javadi, Corporate and Marketing Communications Director, wrote. The filing incorrectly implies that SRI International has endorsed Mr. George's work and or prototype. SRI has not endorsed Mr. George's work or his prototype. The word from Los Alamos National Laboratory isn't any better. It may be more a matter of semantics, Todd A. Hansen, Senior Advisor for Science and Communication, said, because Mr. George did test at least one prototype in the city of Los Alamos, just not at Los Alamos National Laboratory. According to Dale Tuggle, a Los Alamos scientist who has indeed worked as a consultant for Mr. George, they did test a prototype of George's at a private laboratory in Los Alamos. The tests were done by current or retired Los Alamos National Laboratory scientists, and I gather were inconclusive. I am quite certain our laboratory, as a public entity, would not and could not officially endorse Mr. George's work and or prototype, irregardless of its merit or functionality, end quote. And those quotes were gathered by Steve Krivit, writing in New Energy Times. You can dive further down this particular rabbit hole and find some shocking things, I think, at newenergytimes.com. Look for Steve Krivit's new feature, The Wizard of Half Moon Bay, in the September 10th issue. It is practically the unauthorized biography of Russell George and his ventures. Russell George created a series of different companies with names like Equest Technologies, Saturna, and Portal Energies that all traded among themselves. Then, he met Nelson Scalbania, the master of the game. Russ George has also created a medical foundation, the IGA Nephropathy Foundation, in the late 1990s. Russ has this rare kidney disease. The website at IgANfoundation.org says 20-30% of people with IgAN eventually require dialysis and a kidney transplant. Others go on with few symptoms. The foundation, which is legally registered, aims mainly to provide a website of information on alternative treatments. For the first few years, it was a recognized and important source. The site went offline for a while, but reappeared in 2004, and apparently hasn't been updated much since. The foundation webpages continue to ask for donations. It used to accept old cars and jewelry, but has been upgraded to requests for cash, stocks, real estate, and bequests. Send them all to the foundation's address, Pier Number 36 at Half Moon Bay, California, Russ George's boat. Planktos has moved well beyond the days of Russ George and a laptop. The company claims 24 employees and has photos and bios for some of them on its website. The nuclear fusion crowd provides some of those Planktos people. One member of the scientific advisory group for Planktos is Dr. Scott Chubb. Dr. Chubb is an employee of the U.S. Naval Research Laboratory and is known for his work on fusion energy, but not on plankton or trees. And then we have the web warrior, hired by both companies, one David Kubiak. Kubiak is currently the director of communications for both Planktos and D2 Fusion. You will find him almost everywhere Planktos is mentioned online, in discussion groups, blog comments, and press releases. He hunts for critics and answers back. David Kubiak lived in Japan, married there, and claims he taught mass media at a Kyoto university. It was in Japan, at a nuclear fusion experiment, that he met Russ George. On Kubiak's return to the United States, he listed himself as a director of Big Medicine. The medicine, in question, is an overthrow of the business world. Astounded by the all-encompassing corporate culture he witnessed in Japan, Kubiak returned to promote nonviolent revolution against corporate control. He's still at it as an organizer of a conference of Alternative Media versus the Corporate Coup, scheduled for January 25, 2008 at Santa Cruz, California. Personally, I agree with Kubiak on the threat of corporate dominance. We may wish him well, but plotting the overthrow of the capitalist system is a strange mix with his efforts to promote penny stocks in two venture companies. Like Russell George, Kubiak has a couple of personas. David Kubiak became a passionate 9/11 truther, organized conferences, and ran for state senate as a Green 9/11 truth candidate in Maine. In 2004, Kubiak became the executive director of 911truthout.org. He continues to list himself as an international campaign advisor for the 9/11 truth movement. I wonder how David manages the conflict between the global warming deniers that now dominate that movement, like Lauren Moray or Alex Jones, and his employment with Planktos selling carbon credits. Kubiak is still at it. His latest press release was just September 6, 2007, detailing a Zogby poll showing 51% of Americans want Congress to probe Bush and Cheney on 9/11. I'm surprised it's so low. Meanwhile, Nico Haupt, a 9/11 diehard, attacked Kubiak as an establishment plant. Nico thinks Kubiak is too close to government, specifically due to his work with Russell George and various government weapons labs. Could someone with access to Los Alamos lead an anti-government movement? Why did Kubiak, as head of the 9/11 Truth Organization, tell the New York Times the attacks were not an inside job? Almost comically, Haupt wonders whether a secret fusion energy was used to bring down the World Trade Center. All this can be found at 911conspiracy.blogspot.com. Then Kubiak promises the big one, fusion energy for all. Quote, by 2010, cold fusion reactors the size of a dishwasher will offer every household in the industrial world a clean, cheap, and totally decentralized source of heating and electrical power, end quote. Maybe this is one of the big announcements from D2 Fusion Russ George promised us in our interview last week. Just 3 years from now, all problems solved. Meanwhile, despite continuing promotion, company filings show D2 Fusion doesn't have the money it needs to go ahead. Quote, our plan of operation for D2 Fusion will require $2 million in funding over the next 12 months, which funding is not currently available. We will continue to fund limited research and development of D2 Fusion's LENR technology as funding becomes available. End quote. So, unless another big daddy comes along, D2 Fusion looks like it is in storage mode. It was sold this summer to another dormant-looking company, N1 Resources. Well, actually, just like the earlier attempted sale of D2 Fusion to Shadow Marketing, this is a provisional sale. In papers showing N1's deal to loan operating money to D2 Fusion, the signatory is not Russ George, but Nilsson Skalbania. Who will take on this stock market dream now? No product, no revenue, but Russ George is still super enthusiastic about the company. Meanwhile, the same SEC document clearly shows that Solar Energy Limited controls 53.78% of the outstanding shares of Planktos, currently holding 45 million shares. No doubt about it, whoever controls Solar Energy Limited controls Planktos, and that is, by all accounts, Nilsson Skalbania. I'm sure you just heard more about nuclear fusion and the penny stock market than you ever expected from an environment show. The point is, these are the assembled characters we are supposed to trust to really capture the carbon we create in our personal lives and companies and institutions. These are, as one blogger puts it, the new climateer investors. Meanwhile, the company ship has not yet sailed. Planktos announced the Weatherbird 2 would sail in February and then in June. By September, it's still in a yard in Florida. Paul Watson of the Sea Shepherd Society kept his main ship in the Galapagos area just to fend off any iron dumping attempts by Planktos. Watson has been known to ram other ships. But Sea Shepherd says they are leaving, and some doubt whether the Weatherbird will ever go on its voyage. Yet, according to the company website, some of the young, shiny-faced crew are already living on board, awaiting departure. It's become a bit of a drama. Last week, we gave Russell George over 50 minutes to describe and explain his project. Now I'm going to give a mere 9 minutes to one of his strongest critics, Pat Mooney, of the ETC Environment Group.
The ETC group has been critical of Planktos and its plans to dump iron into the Pacific Ocean. We have Pat Mooney from ETC on the line. Hello, Pat.
Hi.
First of all, can you describe the ETC group and what the letters stand for?
Well, we're a small nonprofit civil society organization. We've been around for about 30 years now, and our work is entirely at the global level, really. We work with United Nations agencies and deal with sort of major sort of global biodiversity issues. The full name is a mouthful. It's the Action Group on Erosion Technology and Concentration, but we just say ETC Group or et cetera group.
All right, and your organization has been previously concerned mainly with agriculture and genetic resources and biotechnology. Why are you so opposed to this alleged research voyage by Planktos to find a way, they say, to remove carbon dioxide from the air?
Well, several reasons. One, of course, that it's not just a research voyage. They're talking about actually fertilizing 10,000 square kilometers of ocean, which is a pretty large chunk of ocean. It's by far the biggest experiment of this kind that's been done, and they do hope to make money from it. So it's beyond scientific research to commercialization. Secondly, of course, there isn't a scientific group in the world that we've discovered that actually thinks this is a good idea. There have been a dozen such experiments on a much, much smaller scale by government since about 1993, and all of those have had ambiguous results or concluded that the experiments were failures in the same approach. So for them to now move out from the very small little plots that have been tried out in the past in terms of iron fertilization to take a chunk of the ocean like this and try it out strikes us as foolhardy. And it seems to strike the rest of the scientific community as foolhardy as well, I should add.
Well, you mentioned that in you've got a report online, and on your site it says, in April 2007, 47 ocean scientists writing in the journal Nature concluded that attempts to artificially seed the ocean to sequester carbon will not work. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, that was their conclusion. They've looked at the previous experiments. Again, I said there's been about a dozen over the last dozen years. And on a much smaller scale again, and they found that the experiments were risky and didn't bear results that they thought were beneficial to the environment. They're only, again, one of many groups that have said that. The London Convention, which deals with the law of the sea and the aspects related to sea dumping, also had a meeting just a few weeks ago in which they came roughly to the same conclusion. It was kind of an emergency item on their agenda because they knew that Planktos was about to sail into the Pacific Ocean, and so they concluded that this was a risky proposition and felt that it needed to be studied further before anything much was done. So they're meeting again this autumn to review the situation, but we know that all of the governments that were there, it was unanimous, were alarmed by the Planktos initiative.
And you've teamed up with another group called the ICTA in Washington, that's the International Center for Technology Assessment, to approach the United States government, the EPA, on this. Can you tell us about that?
Well, it's almost the other way around. I think the initial issues came from the EPA itself looking to us for help and advice on how to approach this in terms of international waters. We were quite surprised by that. But they expressed alarm by what was happening, and we've actually had a fairly good dialogue with them, but trying to sort out, well, what can be done if Planktos does work in the waters that don't really belong to any single country. It does look like there are some possibilities, and of course the Ecuadorian government itself, which is the closest to where they say they're going to do their dumping, has already said, the foreign minister has already said, that he will not allow it to happen. And one environmental organization, the Sea Shepherd organization, has said that they will prevent the ship from doing its dumping.
Well, they say they're going to sail soon, but they've been saying that for quite a few months now. We'll see whether they do. If they get the ship away before the London Dumping Convention can meet, would environment groups such as yourself consider appointing an independent scientist to watch what they're doing and see how it's going?
We haven't talked on that. It's an interesting possibility. I think that all of our efforts will be to try to prevent them from doing it in the first place. I don't think we'll be worried about having someone on board so much as preventing them from dumping the iron filings. And my guess is actually we'll be successful at that because, first of all, the company has been delaying its departure for months and months now, and we don't really believe anything they say about departure times or dates. Secondly, I really doubt they're going to get insurance for their vessel to sail into the Pacific Ocean. Given the statements coming from the Ecuadorian government and others, I think that an insurance company would not be pleased at letting them try out this experiment under these conditions.
What really do you think is the possible downside to this? What are we trying to prevent happening?
Well, scientists have said for some time that any sort of iron fertilization of the ocean could dramatically change the biological diversity of the part of the ocean that's dumped in and wherever it drifts to as well. Others have even said, scientists again have said, that this could actually lead to a destruction of biodiversity and a sterilization of parts of the ocean. So that gives us cause for pause. Given that we've had governments, including the Canadian government, over the last dozen years or so, try these things out in a very small scale and come back with results which either worried them or at least were inconclusive, and none of them that were thought to be successful. For this company to commercially go out there and take a big piece of the ocean and try this out is foolhardy.
And he has tried this before in a very small scale with Neil Young's boat, the Ragland, wasn't it called?
Yeah. I went to school with Neil Young in Kelvin High School in Winnipeg many, many moons ago, and I'm quite sure that Neil had no idea that this was what was being done or had no sense or was explained to him that there was a downside to this. I think he just thought he was trying to do something to help out the environment.
Well, let me put a devil's advocate kind of article or argument before you. James Lovelock has claimed that the latest IPCC report predicts summers too hot in Europe by 2040, that crops may not even grow there. He says Europe could have the climate of Australia, except with over 400 million people to feed. And I don't see any signs that the world is producing fewer greenhouse gases. In fact, we're making more. With that kind of a crisis, shouldn't we be finding out how to remove CO2, using algae perhaps, whether it's done by big governments or by private enterprise?
I'm all in favor of experiments to see what can be done and to look at all of our options, and they have to be of two kinds at least. One is we have to cut back in greenhouse gases, and holding out sort of false pie in the sky kind of hopes that don't worry, we can carry on with our existing lifestyle and have our cake and eat it too, because there are these instant sort of silver bullet solutions to our problems. That's just silly. We've got to cut back on our greenhouse gases. Secondly, however, we do need to do the other kinds of experiments that let us see ways in which we can ameliorate the problems that are growing up around us. But to take over chunks of the ocean again and to do this kind of dumping without the kind of scientific basis or logic or anything else that's required, that's just silly. I think we should be doing things that are practical and reasonable, and I know we're going to have to do a lot of experimentation, and both in the stratosphere and on the ocean, but we have to do it with great care. In this current state of panic, rather than trying to really address the problem of our consumption, we're talking about doing geoengineering experiments that really would profoundly alter the environment. Well, you know, that's dangerous. But we know already as human beings that we can geoengineer the environment. That's why we're in this problem in the first place. We haven't shown we've got the brains to get ourselves out of it in terms of other geoengineering experiments. I think, again, just taking control of our own lifestyles first, and secondly, then very careful step-by-step experimentation are the ways to go.
Your group has put out a report on all this called Gambling with Gaia. How can people find that report?
It's available on our website. Of course, it's free, and it's at www.etcgroup.org.
So that's etcgroup.org.
Right.
Okay, well, we've been speaking with Pat Mooney of the ETC Group in Ottawa. Pat, thanks so much for talking with Radio EcoShock, and let's keep in touch on this one.
Good. We're glad to be in touch.
At the end of most Planktos SEC filings, we find the following disclaimer. Forward-looking statements. A number of statements contained in this page are forward-looking statements within the meaning of Section 27A of the Securities Act of 1933 as amended. These forward-looking statements involve a number of risks and uncertainties, including the sufficiency of existing capital resources, uncertainties related to the development of Planktos business plan, and the ability to secure additional sources of financing. The actual results that Planktos Corp may achieve could differ materially from any forward-looking statements due to such risks and uncertainties. End quote. As I cautioned Russ George in our interview, he and his companies are loaded with forward-looking statements. George told a crowd of environmentally friendly folks at the Chicago Green Festival that his company had already taken care of the carbon generated by their coming to the festival. George claims he greened a whole meeting in Monaco, a restaurant in California, and more just by dispensing carbon credits. In fact, he hadn't captured an atom of carbon at that point. No trees planted in Hungary. No plankton fed. He's been handing out these carbon dispensations for years, at least since creating the Planktos Foundation in 2002. He did dump some red paint pigment off the back of Neil Young's yacht, the Raglan. Does that count? The whole project is a forward-looking statement. I don't doubt that Russell George fervently believes the ocean and atmosphere are in serious trouble. Nor does he doubt that he will be recognized as the person who pioneered plant-driven carbon capture and solved the energy problem to boot. He can see it all as done, even while he struggles to raise the money to make it happen and to make his fortune. The money hasn't come for D2 Fusion. Planktos is struggling with low stock prices and plenty of critics, with Greenpeace and the World Wildlife Fund actively fighting the Planktos seeding experiment. It's doubtful big green carbon funds in Europe, where the market is, will go along with Planktos. The irony is, this ardent self-promoter has raised important issues. I think Russ George will be remembered in history. He may become a carbon billionaire or go bankrupt. But consider this. Russ George appears to have invented the idea of a commercially feasible permanent forest, one planted not for the future harvesting, but to capture carbon. His plans to reforest Hungary and their national parks is a very good idea. Ditto his scheme to replenish the forest glory of Haida Gwaii, the Queen Charlotte Islands, off the coast of BC. We should cheer him on and, like the Vatican, accept these as legitimate carbon credits if actually planted. Second, Russ George brought the plight of ocean algae to the public stage. Lots of folks are ready to save whales or even fish, but who's looking at the disastrous crash at the bottom of the food chain? Nobody, it seems, but this green entrepreneur can get major media talking about this developing crisis in the sea. Russell has thrown another looming problem right in our faces, control of the ocean environment. Right now, as his weatherbird wildcatting proves, it is a wild west out there. Fishers and whalers of all nations go out and steal whatever they want from the sea until it is all gone. The sea has no government, no one to protect it from us. Given our true dependence on the oceans, this weakness could be fatal to humanity. I really mean that. On the other hand, I wonder if governments are wrong for the sea. All they do is industrialize, privatize, and corporatize anything they touch. Friends, I can picture the Earth in a strange gyration, the climate shifting uncontrollably. Who knows but a single entrepreneur like Russell George might dash out with a solution that governments and bureaucrats are just too slow and corrupt to undertake? History is full of such examples, the pirates who made nations. We don't know who will really find a way to remove hot carbon from the air. It may just be a fringe inventor who dares all. Is it Russell George? Should we give him a chance just to find out? Or is he a false prophet? I worry about the Planktos algae venture for three reasons. First, I oppose the idea that anyone can just sail out to unilaterally change the ocean. Whether they do it for money or love of the sea is not the point. Let's suppose, deep in New Jersey, a lab scientist named John, complete with a white coat, develops a new superplankton dubbed Plankton B. With designer genetics, it will flourish in any ocean, anywhere. John realizes, without a doubt, that he has solved the problem of declining plankton, and maybe global warming, too. He dedicates himself to reproducing his new algae. John's bosses are not so supportive. Environmentalists complain. The government wants to regulate it, but John is not deterred. He gets a boat, sails out to the Atlantic, raising Plankton B in barrels. Then he pours them overboard. Within months, the ocean develops giant pools of stagnant moss. Plankton B has taken over the ecosystem. I can hear Russ protesting this analogy. Obviously, the Planktos iron feeding project is nothing like a bioengineered monster. Iron dust is natural. Likely, little harm would come from the first voyage of the Weatherbird 2. Other similar experiments have been done by the joint action of major governments and real ocean scientists. But the principle, Russ, is exactly the same. The principle, someone less caring than you, but just as passionate and sure of his cause, can go ahead and enact their plan by your example. This is what the Friends of Earth meant in their press release, their objection to using the ocean as a private for-profit petri dish. Individuals and small companies with no oversight should not be allowed to dabble with the ecosystem of the sea to make a buck. That endangers everyone. Second, just the idea of carbon offsets gives me the willies. It lets us keep on polluting. I'm not worried about my SUV gas guzzler because I paid Russell George and some algae a few bucks to soak up my soot. Why bother ending coal or saving power? You get the picture. Then we have the fatal problem, in my opinion, of verification. As David Santillo, our Greenpeace scientist, said, there is no system of verification to know the carbon remained in the ocean. We can guess, we can extrapolate from measurements, but no human technology so far can really know whether a ton of carbon dioxide, allegedly grabbed by Planktos phytoplankton, really stayed in the sea. The science we have is too vague. We lack certainty. Worse, Russell George has a record of manipulating appearances. Some of his claims don't stand up to close scrutiny, to fact-checking. And the controlling stockholder of Planktos has already been criminally convicted of breach of trust. None of this promises confidence to the carbon buyer. Meanwhile, behind the scenes, company names and stocks are thrashing around with hidden characters, offshore trading, and questionable promotions. No transparency. It smells fishy. How can Russell George come back from the first trial of the Weatherbird 2 and say it failed? He risks losing millions of dollars in carbon credits. Already on the financial knife edge, George might lose his company and his reputation. Surely, we already know, as Russell George seems to assume, that he will return claiming huge amounts of carbon dioxide was captured. Failure in a scientific experiment is the most common result, but stock sales are not built on failure. Most companies deny bad news, some fudge the results until they go down with the ship. Huge companies do it, and little companies do it. Is this really research or venture capitalism on the loose in a new and under-regulated market? Selling to our fears of global warming. I don't think we can buy our way out. We must stop adding greenhouse gases to the atmosphere. That is nature's ultimatum, and she is the final judge. This is Alex Smith. Come along for the radio ride each week with me on Radio EcoShock. Find us at the website ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock, like an electric shock, .org. And thanks for listening.
It's green, see? A green fix should last a long time.